Live from Los Angeles, it's the Life Changes Show.
Look at the bright lights. Look at the bright lights.
With tonight's guest, actor, writer, and comedian Tom Tran.
Look at the night sky. Look at the night sky.
And musical guest, Murray Hittery. I am Mark Lejeur, and now your host, the MC, the master of change, Filippo Voltaggio.
I think I've talked about this before, but if I didn't mention it, so Facebook, for those of you who don't know, has this way of blocking. I don't know if this happens for everybody or those of us who just get a lot of Facebook messages and a lot of requests and stuff like that. But it blocks certain things from people thinking, you know, you don't need to see this, or these people aren't important to you, or these people aren't your friends. I don't know what the algorithm is, but there's a way to find those. And I recently found them, and I think I mentioned some things that I found there. Well, I'm still finding things there because there was just so much. And recently, most recently, I found a letter from a guy written in Italian, or a message from a guy written in Italian that said that he and his wife had met a friend of mine in Italy. And this friend's name is Marco Yerva. And that this friend, they were on vacation or something and struck up a conversation with my friend Marco Yerva. And Marco said some things to them that stuck with them. And he also recommended that they read some books, and they ended up reading them, and their lives were changed because of that conversation with Marco Yerva. Well, they never exchanged numbers, they never exchanged anything, and so this guy was reaching out to me because he wanted to connect with Marco Yerva and thank him and let him know how he had changed their lives and how grateful they were. Well, like I said, these messages have been in there for years. And so this was many years ago that this message was sent to me. And what has happened in the meantime is that Marco Yerva died. And I felt so bad that I didn't see this message and wasn't able to connect them, because how wonderful I thought would it have been for Marco Yerva to have known this before he passed. And I wrote the guy back and I apologized for not having seen the message before, and he wrote me back saying that don't worry, we found another way to get to him soon after that we had written you, but they did get to talk to Marco and before he passed. And so I was happy about that. And I'm mentioning this for a couple reasons, because A, Marco got to hear how he changed that person's life. But he has since passed, and there are so many more people, because I know Marco Yerva, that he touched and he affected, that he did not know potentially in his lifetime how much he affected their life. And so here he is now gone, but the effect of what he has done or did in this lifetime continues on and on, and I'm able to witness this on his behalf. And so I think to myself, all of these people who are doing things like our guest tonight, Tom Tran, and our musical guest, Murray Hittery, and that people are affected. Some people they know, and some people tell them. Some people don't tell them, and some they'll never know, and it'll go on for years, long after they're gone, and I hope they're here for a very long time, doing what they do to help so many people in two distinct, very different ways. Look forward to talking about that on the Life Changes Show right after this.
You are listening to the Life Changes Show, live from Studio NoHo on the BBS Radio Network. You can hear tonight's show and all our past shows, which include luminaries such as Marianne Williamson, Gary Anthony Williams, Sharon Stone, and Alex Gray, on our archive page at lifechangesshow.com. Or you can visit us online via Twitter at Life Changes Show and Facebook at The Life Changes Show.
We're back. I am Filippo Voltaggio sitting here with Mark Lejeur. And Mark, I know we've talked about this kind of thing many times, but it's certainly good to repeat.
So many times we've talked about this, and it just calls to mind more and more why to be watching how you treat people all the time. And not just some of the time, because you don't know when you're affecting them in either way, a positive or negative, and whether or not you're leaving them with something that's lasting because you projected a moment of frustration that's in your day, and that sticks with them, versus I had a moment in high school that you remind me of where I had a conversation, and it was just a normal conversation, and I found out 30 years later that it changed the direction of this person. I would have never known.
So, right. Yeah. And now that we're doing what we're doing, and like our guests and our musical guests doing what they're doing, and it just keeps going out there and affecting more and more people.
So, absolutely.
Can't wait to get right into it. Our guest is a Los Angeles-based comedian, a musician. I understand he's an actor, too, and a U.S. military veteran.
Actor in quotes.
Actor in quotes. U.S. military veteran and advocate. Tom Tran started his career as a stand-up comic after a combat injury ended his career as a soldier. Looking forward, well, we're going to hear about it. Here he is, Tom Tran. Welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on. First of all, can I say, what Facebook algorithm is keeping people off your page that you don't want to see? Because I would love for Facebook to stop telling me I should be friends with my ex-girlfriends. At least once or twice a week. I'm like, you should know this girl. I'm like, I know her. I don't want to know her anymore. That's why we're not friends on Facebook. So I don't know what algorithm Facebook's using for you. I would like that algorithm, please.
That's nice. And you know what? I can't always find it, but if you find it, you'll find things in there that are even probably more shocking.
I think what you're talking about is like the messages that people send you, but they're not connected to you, so you won't see them.
That's it, the messages.
Right. Yeah. So I've gotten some of those messages where like people are like, hey, you know, they're not in my circle of like friends.
They're all from your ex-girlfriend.
You know what? Listen, the internet's the worst thing that ever happened in my love life because they can find me anytime that they want to or don't want to. But I do get messages from people who like they've seen me at shows or whatever, and you know they'll just want to reach out.
And sometimes I get those too, and then I find all these of stuff that I didn't get. So I don't know what the algorithm is, but I love how you could just jump right in like you do, and come to think of it, of course you're on radio.
I work on the radio here in Los Angeles.
Yeah, in more ways than one. And we'll talk about the other way in a minute. But you do the traffic?
I am a traffic reporter for a CBS radio station here in Los Angeles.
You're right.
Monday through Friday, 10 to 2. I am literally the guy that tells people how to drive.
Yes.
Which is confusing because I'm Asian and we're not really good at driving. So it's really...
No, we don't have to put that out there. It makes for a funny joke. I've seen you do it.
It's one of my opening jokes, man. I'll write a new opening joke, but until that day comes.
It's a funny joke. And I'm glad we can still joke about that. Whether that's true or not, people do laugh. But hopefully people aren't hurt by any of that.
No.
And so it makes me wonder how you're able to find humor in the kind of things that some of the kind of things that you talk about, and we'll get into that actually. But so right out of school, you went into the Army.
Yeah, I joined the Army. Actually, I joined the Army February 1997, a couple of weeks before I turned 18. I tried to join the Army. Let's put it that way. I tried to join the Army a couple of weeks before I turned 18, but my mom would not sign the paperwork because I was not 18 yet. Because my father was a prisoner of war in Vietnam. She had literally like gone through this once with her husband, my father, she was not about to sign over her 17-year-old son. So I just looked at my recruiter. I was like, you know, I'll be 18 in like 2 weeks, right? And he's like, yeah, why don't you just come back in 2 weeks? So I enlisted on my 18th birthday, or a couple days actually after. Finished high school, left for basic training August 1997. And never looked back. Well, until that thing happened in Iraq. Then I looked back.
Yeah, something, yeah. You made it up the ranks for like, you know, 6 years. You kept going up and up within the ranks. And then you got,
deployed.
Yeah.
I joined a peacetime army. So Clinton was my president when I joined. Mm. And despite what you think about Clinton, he was a good commander-in-chief. We got pay raises and everything was kind of tranquilo for a while. You know, September 11th happened. We went to Afghanistan, and shortly after, we went into Iraq. And I deployed to Iraq December 2003. No, December 2002. I got my orders, and I got into Iraq January 2003. Well, into Kuwait, anyway, into the country, into the operation area of operations. Across the border, March 29th, 2003, my first mission outside the wire. On April 3rd, 2003, I took a 7.62 round from an AK-47 to the back of the head. So, and I say that very nonchalantly now because it's been 12, 13 years since it happened. And I literally talk about it on stage. It's you know, something that I'm very open about because...
You make jokes about it on
stage. I make jokes about it because if I didn't, I would probably have snapped. And that's the honest to God's truth. I mean, on the day, and there's video of the moment I was shot. You can hear the bullet hit my head. You can hear the immense amount of cussing that came immediately after that. And for an hour and a half until we got back to our base, Talil Air Base, it was me joking because I knew that if I stopped for a moment to come to terms with the fact that I just took a round to the back of the skull, I would have freaked out. Yeah. But I was a 23-year-old staff sergeant in charge of a bunch of 18 and 19-year-old kids, and I could not freak out. I couldn't be the one who lost it because it was day four. It was day four in Iraq, and if Staff Sergeant Tran lost it, then these kids had no hope. Hmm. So, and there's a video of me in the backseat of my Humvee joking the entire way back to the hospital.
Was it funny?
No, it's not funny at all. Not when I think about it now, but at the moment, on the day, I was like, okay, well, what are you going to do to keep talking? And I had combat lifesaver for training, so one of the things I did not want to do was go into shock.
Right.
So to keep myself from going to shock, I would just talk out loud, just spewing nonsense, talking to my colonel, talking to my major, asking how many hot nurses were at the hospital who were going to be treating me. Were they going to be treating me? Like that, just kind of,
that's kind of
keeping
funny,
the adrenaline going. Because that's, and comedy's always been an adrenaline thing for me, like whether I'm laughing or I'm telling jokes. I get a boost of adrenaline from that.
You know, it's interesting you say comedy's always been, but at that point, like in high school, you were like a quiet person.
I was, but comedy came into my life when I was very young. My uncle owned a video store in my hometown, and he would let me and my brothers and sisters go borrow VHS tapes on the weekends. And I remember grabbing Eddie Murphy's Delirious as a 7-year-old and watching it because my parents were terrible at their job as parents. And comedy was always a thing that I loved. It wasn't a thing I ever thought I was going to do. I mean, I grew up trying to relate to a tall black man in a purple leather suit. Like there was, for me, there was no direct link to comedy. It was a thing that I loved. But I didn't think I was going to do it. I thought I was going to be Eddie Van Halen growing up.
Well, I was about to say, I said you were a quiet person, like an introvert in high school, but you were also a loud person, just people didn't know it. So tell us how you were loud.
I played in a rock band. I still play in rock bands. But I played in rock bands growing up in high school. But I always played with guys that were way older than me because, like, my brother was actually the reason... My brother's the reason I started playing rock and roll. Like, the first lick I ever played was Bon Jovi's You Give Love a Bad Name, because that's what my brother was playing back in 1986. And so the people that I was hanging out with were my brother's friends, and as I was growing up, I was playing with them.
Ah, okay.
And or people around their age. So, you know, as a 15-year-old, I was playing with 25-year-olds, and I wasn't hanging out with people in my high school. So all people in my high school knew was I was this quiet kid who played like in the jazz band, like very quietly behind the scenes, just like creepily looking at the high school girls. I was in high school, so it was okay at the time. Not now, that'd be weird. But I was, you know, I was not boisterous. I was not a class clown. I didn't have a lot of friends because I kind of went high school to high school for a little bit. And I was just trying to make it through. I was just trying to make it through those 4 years without having any attention drawn to me.
Interesting.
And then I wind up in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Doing what I do for a living. So
right.
A lot of people are like, how did this happen? Like, I don't know, man. I don't know how it happened.
Well, we have an idea from your story, and I think we're going to get more of an idea and then talk about what you've done with what happened. And so look forward to talking more about that with our guest, Tom Tran, and a little later on, live music here in the studio with Murray Hittery, all on the Life Changes show after this.
Listen to these words. He would not be beat by forces too fierce for man, woman, or beast. As the going got tougher, his courage increased. It's a little story with a big message, a message that speaks to children of all ages. It's about believing in yourself, overcoming obstacles, and never giving up. It's been called a masterpiece, one of the finest children's books ever written, and a true children's classic. Shadow Stevens has been called Dr. Seuss for the 21st century. His big little book, The Big Galoot, is a story about bullying. Bullying has become an American epidemic, and The Big Galoot talks about it in a way that will touch the heart of a child of four and a grandfather of 104. It's the story of a little boy with size 42 hands, the biggest hands anyone has ever seen, and the kids laugh at him, then the laughter turns mean. They mock him and trip him, and much worse. But throughout it all, Warren Galoot says, I'm a galoot, but I have good luck. You can't get me down. I never give up. A second grader named Chandler said, I thought it was the best funny book I have seen in my life. And we agree. Whoopi Goldberg said, this is a great story. Bravo, Shadow. The Big Galoot is available now as an ebook exclusively on Kindle Fire on Amazon for only $3.98. We strongly urge you to get it for your children, your children's children, or as a gift to yourself. Its message speaks to all of us. Have good luck and never give up. Go to Amazon.com and search for The Big Galoot by Shadow Stevens.
You are listening to The Life Changes Show, live from Studio NoHo on the BBS Radio Network. You can hear tonight's show and all our past shows, which include luminaries such as The Green Children, Dan Millman, Hot Rod Fuller, and Mike Marino on our archive page at LifeChangesNetwork.com. You can also follow us online via Twitter at Life Changes Show and Facebook at The Life Changes Show.
We're back. I'm Filippo, sitting here with Mark and our guest, Tom Tran, talking about comedy and that moment that you had with the bullet. You got released from the Army soon after.
Nope. Within,
oh, that's right.
Nope. I stayed. I got shot April 3rd, 2003. And what actually happened is we did another mission before I went to the hospital. So the initial contact happened during a recon operation. The Special Forces team that was holding the city, they were leaving and they were turning it over to our team. And we drove literally into a gunfight. And then I got shot. Luckily, I was combat lifesaver trained. I bandaged myself up. And as we're heading out of the city.
That part's real. I bandaged
myself up. I literally, on the video, you see me bandaging my own head.
Now, I thought that was I haven't seen the video, but I thought that was a joke. Nope. That you bandaged yourself up.
Literally bandaged my own head. It was actually funny. The Special Forces medic came up to me later. He's like, hey, so was it handicap day at the medical house? Who bandaged your head? I was like, I did. Like, when was the last time you bandaged your own skull during a gunfight? I'm going to go with never, Jeff. So shut up. But I bandaged my own head, and we were about to leave the city when we got another radio call. And they're like, hey, what are you guys doing? They failed to mention, hey, Sergeant Tran's been shot. They're like, wow. Hey, we're leaving this AO. We're getting out of this gunfight. They're like, well, something's happening over at the mayor's office in this city. And it's the city was Anasarija, which is the city where Jessica Lynch was taken prisoner, and that's where she was rescued. She was the first POW since World War II to have been rescued. And that's the city. It was that city 2 days after they rescued her was when I got shot.
Wow.
So as we were leaving, we get a radio call. They said there's something going on over at the mayor's office. And we get there. There's a crowd of like 200. And now we have to quell this crowd. And the SF captain looks at me and goes, hey, can you just watch the trucks? I'm like, yeah, man. I'll just stand here and watch the trucks because I'm not going to do any good over there. So we actually had to do another mission. And then got back in the trucks. They're like, you want to go to the hospital? I'm like, yeah, let's go to the hospital. So
wow.
We drove back to the hospital. Or we drove back to the base. And I don't tell this story on stage because I just don't have the time. But like we call back to the my operations center, and we're like, "Hey, we're on our way back." And I said, "But we have to stop at the hospital because I sort of got shot." And the guy back in my op center goes, "What do you mean you sort of got shot?" I'm like, "Well, it's going to sound way worse than it is. I got shot in the head." And then we lose communication. So the retrans operator, the guy on another radio at the hospital that's on Talil Air Base, calls up and says, "Hey, Sergeant, I can hear you. I can hear your base. You tell me what's going on, and I will relay it to them." I said, "Well, yeah, I got shot." And he goes, "Yeah, I heard that part. Where did you get shot?" I said, "Again, this is going to sound way worse than it is."
It sounds pretty bad.
It does sound pretty bad. I said, "I got shot in the head." And he's like, "What?" I was like, "Yeah, man, I told you. It's going to sound worse than it is, but we're on our way back." And this is very distinctly like one of those joking times where he goes, "Well, how long are you gonna, is it going to be till you get back?" I said, "Well, my buddies over at 323 got some coffee brought up from Kuwait, and I heard they got some killer donuts, so we're going to stop there." And the guy on the radio goes,
"So
no,
you
no.
were funny, actually."
Well, I was just trying to, I mean, it's a tense situation. We just came out of a gunfight, and I'm bleeding from my skull.
Yeah.
One of the most upsetting parts of that day to me was that was a clean uniform for the first time in 3 weeks. Like, the war had started, I put a clean uniform on that day, and on the video, you hear me complaining that there's blood on my shoulder. Oh. Like, that's what I'm worried about.
Well, maybe that's good that you had something like that to worry about.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was very clearly just trying to alleviate the tension in the room. Yeah. I didn't want to be the guy that everybody's, like, freaking out. Because when we got to the hospital, all they had heard was, "Oh, this sergeant who was out with an SF team got shot in the head," so they were expecting the worst. So they came out with stretchers and IVs. The whole hospital comes out. Colonel comes out screaming, "Where's this guy?" And I hopped out of the Humvee. I'm like, "Hang on, Jeff, Steve, come here. Let's take a picture. I haven't seen you guys since we were in Fort Bragg, like a couple of my SF buddies." Wow. So there's a photo of me in front of this hospital with a bandage on my head,
right?
Just stupid grin, ear to ear with a couple of my SF buddies. And the colonel's like, "What is wrong with him?" And my colonel's like, that's Sergeant Tran. You will meet him again, I'm sure."
And you will know his name. You parlayed that into not only, but you left after a year, right?
My 1 year deployment ended January 2004. 12 months boots on the ground was, at the time, the length of deployments. I mean, at one point it was like 15, 16 months for some guys. But I left after my 1 year deployment, went home.
So then you parlayed that into not only humor for yourself, but then you got other people involved and you started the GIs of Comedy, where you not only, and you started a foundation, right?
I tried to start a foundation. Actually, my roommate, Specialist Charles Bush, was killed December 19th, 2003, which was about 2 weeks before we came back to the States. Oh. So he'd made it 11 and a half months, and an improvised explosive device killed him. And he left his family without a father, and his kids are college age. So at one point, I wanted to start a foundation to help send his kids to college and kids like his to college, you know, the children of special operations personnel who've been killed in the line of duty, and I wanted to help send them to college. And I was going to call it the Specialist Charles Edward Bush Foundation. And then one of my SF buddies goes, "You know, we have one of those already, right? It's called the Special Operations Warrior Foundation," which does that exact thing. And it was started back in 1983 after Operation Eagle Claw, which was the failed rescue attempt of the Iranian hostages, where a group of Delta operators were killed when a helicopter crashed into their plane in the desert. And that day, the surviving operators of that mission decided they were going to start a foundation, and the children of those operators would never have to want to go to school. Like, they provide scholarships for these children. So my buddy was like, "Yeah, we already have one of those. It's called the Special Operations Warrior. It's literally the thing you want to do." I was like, "Well, that saves me a lot of paperwork." Like, I was talking to my lawyer. He's like, "You got a 501c3, this man." And he's like, at one point I was like, "Do I really want to do this?" And then I found out that there is one. And since then we've been donating money to this charity. When we go out on tour, we sell tour t-shirts and merchandise, and half of the proceeds of everything we sell go directly to the foundation.
Wow, half.
The other half, yeah. Wow. When I tell comics half, they're like, "Really?"
Yeah.
But yeah, it's the GIs of comedy was never a money-making endeavor for me. Like, people are like, what's it like being a nonprofit? And we're not. We just don't make money. It's just, like, I give half the money to the foundation. We literally just wrote them a check for several thousand dollars. And the other half goes to buy more stuff so we can keep doing it.
So you're out there as a comedian on tour yourself, and then you're out there also doing the GIs of comedy tour.
Right.
And then you also gig as a musician still, right?
I do. I currently have three working cover rock bands. And it's just a thing my wife says I do to rationalize all the guitars that I have. People ask her, they're like, don't you get mad that he buys guitars? And she's like, he doesn't drink, he doesn't smoke, he doesn't gamble, doesn't go to strip clubs. No, he can buy guitars. That's fine. But I love music. If I could have been Eddie Van Halen, I would have. But, you know, I hit that place when I was 18. And I was like, well, this isn't going to happen. And I had a tradition of the military in my family. My father was a prisoner of war. My grandfather and my uncle were killed during the Vietnam War.
Wow.
And, you know, my family came to the United States with nothing, literally with nothing. We grew up in the projects of Buffalo, New York. And, you know, when I turned 18, the first adult decision I made was to give back to the country that let me call it home. Mm. And this is, I've been here since I was 13 months old. So I don't know Vietnam, never been there, can't go back. So I put on the uniform and I fought for this country.
Wow. And now sometimes you wear the uniform when you're doing comedy, right?
No. I'll wear the uniform if I have to go to, like, the Army Ball, which I've performed at. I'll show up in uniform, but then I will take it off and I'll put on a suit or something. But that's one of the things with the GIs of comedy that's made us successful. We all have a reverence still for the military.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are a lot of comedians, a lot of entertainers who are in the military. Problem is, not a lot of people had great experiences in the military. I have comics who are still in the military. One guy is a lieutenant colonel, just made lieutenant colonel after, you know, 21 years of service. Another guy's a major. Another guy's a master sergeant. Another guy just retired after 20 years. So we have had long, honorable careers where we had great experiences, and we love it so much still, which is why we do it. So when I show up to an Army base, or any base for that matter, I want to make sure I don't show up looking like, you know, a bag of trash. I don't want these guys going, dude, don't say you're representing us. I've been out of the Army for 12 years. I go running every day. I work out every day because I'm representing our military.
Yeah, and I can't imagine you'd show up looking like a bag of trash, the guy who's worried about his blood getting on a clean uniform.
Here's the thing. Some guys do, man. There are comics who, and not just comics, a lot of people leave the military and they're like, I am done with the military. And then they fully engulf themselves in the civilian world. And then when it's advantageous for them, they pull out the veteran card.
Mm.
And I don't do that. I hate doing that. If I'm going as a comic or as the leader of this group of veteran comedians, if we're going to represent our military and the other people still serving, we're going to act like it. We're not going to be typical comedian douchebags, which we are. We can be. Like, I'm not a... Like, catch me at the Hollywood Laugh Factory on a Friday night on the midnight show. It's probably going to be way different than if I'm at the Army Ball. But we understand that when we're in that place, whether it's on a base here in the States or overseas, and we're about to do our sixth overseas tour to our 20th country in 3 years performing for soldiers around the world. We know that when we're there, we have to represent ourselves and the uniforms we wore. I've got guys in every branch of the military, and nobody wants to be that guy. And I expect more of them.
Well, it says a lot about you. Maybe your parents did do a good job after all.
Didn't watch Eddie Murphy when I was seven, man. I don't know.
Well, there are worse things they could do. So people could learn more about you, obviously, at Tom Tran. And Tom is spelled T-H-O-M. And then Tran, T-R-A-N. So tomtran.com or GIs of Comedy, which is G-I-S for GIs of Comedy.com. And people can learn more about you there. And quickly, we want to mention that you have a show coming up here on November 9th starting, called Battle Scars. Tell us quickly what that's about.
The Panoply Network approached me about doing a show where I would talk to other veterans of Operation Iraqi Freedom and Operation Enduring Freedom, so the Afghanistan and Iraq War, and give them an opportunity to tell their stories. Because we live and work in Hollywood. We know that the stories that Hollywood tells are always the grandiose, Zero Dark 30, all those. But there are literally millions of veterans who have served, and we all have stories.
Yeah.
And they're not all maybe world-changing, but many of them are life-changing.
Definitely.
So this is an opportunity for those soldiers and sailors and airmen, not just of the U.S. military, foreign militaries that have worked with us, who can tell these stories. And I can bring that little bit of levity.
Yeah. Can't think of anybody better.
But at the same time, relate to them better than anyone else can. Like, I'll know what you can joke about. I'll know what you can't joke about.
Right.
And it's a great show. I'm looking forward to it. It premieres November 9th on the Panoply Network. It'll be available on Apple iTunes and all that happiness.
And it's called Battle Scars.
Battle Scars.
With Tom Tran as
Amazing.
Host. So thank you so much. This is amazing.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me over, man.
Yeah, and I don't know how you did it, but you did it. I'm glad you're doing it, and so what a pleasure. So, Tom Tran, looking forward to getting to experience you live at the Laugh Factory or somewhere soon here in Hollywood. Looking forward to it. All right, so we'll be back with our guest, musical guest, Murray Hideri, and we're going to have a mind travel experience happening right here for all of us, right in the studio when we come back, and our Ask Dorothy segment's coming up right here, too, on the Life Changes Show after this.
The Little Dog That Could is the fantastically true story of a man and a little dog that came into his life as his mentor to help him understand the world beyond his human senses and to experience life, love, and healing beyond his human understanding. Best-selling author Filippo Voltaggio, who currently hosts the highly regarded Life Changes show, is an internationally known singer, speaker, and life coach. Filippo offers up his own story, how one little surprise package in fur and four legs transformed his life unexpectedly forever and furthered his path of self-discovery. In The Little Dog That Could, Filippo brings to life the meaning of the adage, "When the student is ready, the teacher appears." Through the reading of this book, you will experience the journey of real miracles that transcend time, space, and logic while gaining practical tools that will help you navigate your way. The Little Dog That Could is available through Amazon and Barnes & Noble. For more information, visit thelittledogthatcould.com. That's thelittledogthatcould.com.
You are listening to The Life Changes Show, live from Studio NoHo on the BBS Radio Network. You can hear tonight's show and all our past shows, which include luminaries such as Mariel Hemingway, Shadow Stevens, Gary Zukav, and Kyle Cease, on our website at lifechangesshow.com. You can also follow us online via Twitter at Life Changes Show and at Facebook at The Life Changes Show.
We are back. I'm Filippo, sitting here with Mark and, of course, our guest, Tom Tran. And joining us in the studio is Dorothy for an Ask Dorothy segment. But before that, Mark, I believe we have a shout-out.
We do. We want to give a shout-out to Deborah Roseman and our friends at the HeartMath Institute. HeartMath was founded by Doc Children in 1991 to help individuals, organizations, and the global community incorporate the heart's intelligence into their day-to-day experience of life. They're really doing some amazing work. Check them out, heartmath.com. Dorothy, my name is Bill, and I am from Los Angeles, California. I just recently lost my position with one of the largest companies in the world, and I'm devastated. I find myself crying every day and all night since I was let go. What I don't understand is that although I was not happy with the company nor with my position, it feels like this is the end of my world. How can I pull myself out of this abyss of pain and suffering?
Bill, this happened to me years ago, and I chose to stay in pain and misery for way too long. Becoming suddenly unemployed is a big change, and even though change is the only constant in this world, we humans seem to resist it. The secret and the key to change is to let go of fear. In order to do this, we must first define what the fear is, and then choose to face it and embrace it. I believe the most important question for you here is, is one that I ask all of my clients. If you could do anything at all and not fail, what would you be doing? Would you be working for another large company and continue to show up and not like your job? Or is there something else that your heart yearns for you to be doing? Are you possibly allowing fear of failure to stop you from embracing your passion? When I was in this situation many years ago, I allowed fear to stop me from doing the work I had come to do. I didn't believe it was possible for me to be who I am today. Fortunately, through asking the right questions and with the help from some awakened friends, I was able to discern that my fear was all about continuing to show up and do work that I was very good at, but in a job that I didn't really like. There is a great technique that helped me find and free myself from the fear and agony of being unemployed. This technique is simple. Ask the right questions of yourself. If you would take a few minutes each day to journal about how you feel about your future and ask questions like the ones I have suggested, you will find the answers you seek. If you aren't sure as to what your life's mission and purpose truly is, then this is the time to discover it. When we ask the right questions, we find amazing answers that can set us free from fears, worries, and doubts about the future.
Thank you. And if any of you have a question for Dorothy, please write her at askdorothy@lifechangesshow.com.
Thank you. Thank you, Dorothy. And we'll be right back with our musical guest, Murray Hideri, right here on the Life Changes Show right after this.
There are self-help seminars costing thousands of dollars guaranteeing miraculous transformations. There are compelling speakers and life-changing weekend experiences where you can walk on fire. They all deliver revelations that guarantee you'll come back for the more expensive revelations filled with even greater wonder next month on Fiji. We get addicted to positive, heartfelt, expensive theater. What we really need is a jumpstart, an awakening, someone who can give us a reminder that everything we need lies within. Through inspiration and practical knowledge, Dorothy Donahue helps people get grounded and motivated, inspired and energized. It's not just words and affirmations and the power of intention. It's a mindset brought about by a tangible, transcendental experience, an audio-visual, physical, spiritual experience that helps us realize we transform ourselves. We get tools to become the conscious co-creators of lives of unlimited potential. Find out more. Go to DorothyDonahue.com.
The Life Changes Show is a premier radio show presented by the Life Changes Network, which is a company whose team has dedicated their lives not only to positive change, but to helping others observe and embrace, honor, and even celebrate their own changes, thus enabling a more positive, inspired life and helping to create a more positive and inspired world. From everyday people, celebrities, corporate giants, and children, we are here to help and to serve. With heart, integrity, and experience, we bring our message and positive intent into your lives through the Life Changes Show, lifechangesnetwork.com, and through guest appearances on other inspiring shows and events. If you wish to learn more about Life Changes Life Coaching, a private consultation with one of us, corporate or live event appearances, or if you would like us to appear on your radio or TV shows, please email us at info@lifechangesnetwork.com.
We are back. Our musical guest is Murray Hideri. He is a multidisciplinary artist and a tech pioneer. His purpose-driven approach is at the heart of Murray's business successes, acclaim as a visual artist, and global recognition as a musician. Ever pushing boundaries and guided by a strong desire to help people find their purpose, Murray is now focused on his provocative musical experience, Mind Travel, touring it across the globe while also crafting his next project, No Dream Left Behind. Welcome to the show, Murray.
Thank you, Filippo. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. We came to know you through Mark Legere, who shared a video with us. You had a grand piano in the middle of a forest or something. Am I correct?
That is a true statement. I can back that up. I have photos and video to prove that, though it totally befuddled the rangers at the Sequoia National Forest.
I'm sure.
We did actually carry a grand piano down into the forest and did a concert by the Sequoias. It was pretty magical.
I can't imagine. And the next time you do that, could you please let us know so we all could be there as well?
Absolutely.
But we get to be right here with you and get to experience mind travel. What is mind travel?
So mind travel has been a lifelong dream for me, and it started as a personal practice, as my own way to use music to just deal with life, just deal with the ups and downs of life. So I would end each day by just sitting at the piano and playing, and as a not just a pianist, but as a composer, I would start improvising and just really tap into kind of that part of us that's inside.
Nice.
And just go on this musical journey of sorts. So in the last few years, I've now brought that personal practice out into the world. And we've had now tens and tens of thousands of people experience mind travel live.
Wow. Okay. So you say it's been a lifelong experience for you. When does this actually start? When did music come into your life this importantly?
So I started playing when I was 6 years old at the piano, and I was a pretty shy kid. And so music very quickly became the way that I felt really comfortable expressing myself. Mm. And then when I got to high school, that's when it really kicked in that I didn't just want to play other people's music. Mm. I was studying classical and some beautiful, gorgeous music, but I realized that it wasn't kind of my calling to just interpret those pieces, but to really, I had my own thing to say musically, and I knew I wanted to be a composer, and that's what I ended up studying at university in New York.
And so that you studied and you performed your own music this whole time?
So I went to NYU, got my degree in classical composition, and then when I graduated, I was like, how am I going to make any money with this classical music thing? Mm. And I spoke to other guys that graduated with a similar degree in composing, and a lot of them would go into writing, you know, jingles for TV or, you know, stuff like that. And if that's what you want to do, that's your dream, that's awesome. But I would ask them, like, you know, when did you write your first symphony? And they look at me totally puzzled, like, there's no time for that. Like, you know, they're on deadline, they're, you know. Mm. And so the money was good for them, but they never actually got to write the music they wanted to write. And I felt like, wow, that message really hit home. And I was like, that sounds like a kind of form of torture to me. So I said, how can I separate out, you know, having to make money right now at 21 from, you know, writing the symphonic stuff I wanted to write? And then my older brother and I started chatting. I was explaining my frustrations to him. And he was, you know, really into computers, really into tech stuff. And the next thing, you know, he and I started an internet company and just got into that at a really early stage in the mid-90s. So we got into it at a really early point, and we built an amazing company. It was called Earthweb, which then became Dice, which is till today the biggest job board career site for tech people. And we took that public in the late 90s, in 1998, and it was a total American dream come true. Kind of looking back at that, you know, my father was with us on the stock exchange floor.
Oh.
And you know, his father, my grandfather, came to this country with nothing from Syria, actually, from Aleppo, Syria, the same city that's been devastated.
Wow.
Now. And so he came about 100 years ago, you know, with nothing, and built the family on the Lower East Side of New York City. Lived in tenements. I mean, really, like, peddled on the streets, and built the family from nothing.
Wow,
and
what a moment to be there on the stock exchange.
Yeah,
the whole thing, but
it was truly magic. And my dad had no idea what we were doing for a bunch of years with this tech stuff until he looked at the board on the stock exchange. He was like, I think I get it now. You know.
Oh wow.
And and for me, it was a real kind of homecoming from that point of view. And it's interesting, you know, growing up where I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, in the community I grew up in, you know, music's great, but kind of as a side thing, you know. And until you have some success in business, you know, you're kind of not a real man in that sense. And I knew music was my passion, and I knew I was going to go back to music. But having that early success with business when I was in my 20s, just was really, super lucky, and also put me in a position where I could, you know, continue with my music. And so I played every day as, you know, with my startup, you know, in the office in New York, I had a piano in my office.
Nice.
And after those 12, 14-hour days, I just sit at the piano, and I just kind of let it go.
Wow.
And that's, you know, and that's where this whole thing started. And I started to couple that with my studies of Eastern philosophy, and I got into meditation, and I got into just a lot of music from the East, in particular from Japan, music of the Zen Buddhist monks, and I started to fuse all that together, and that became the voice, the musical voice that I share with today.
Well, speaking of the fusing, somehow you also studied physics and fused this in there too.
Right. So all this kind of comes down to like an overriding interest and curiosity in, like, what are we even doing here, like, in this universe? Mm. Like, how did this even happen? And just my intense and kind of fierce curiosity in just trying to gain some level of understanding as best as we can with our limitations. And so I really approached it from different facets of the same problem. So I use Eastern philosophy and ancient wisdom, and I study what people have been, you know, studying for thousands of years, what the, you know, ancient Vedic teachers taught 3,000 years ago in India, you know, what the Kabbalist Jewish mystics, you know, taught, you know, 1,500 years ago, and the Buddhist monks and what they teach, and just trying to kind of find what makes sense for me. And then I fuse that with the most up-to-date latest discoveries in physics. And so till today, I meet weekly with my teacher from Caltech, and we sit for hours every week and just deep dive into the latest and greatest from, you know, special relativity, general relativity to quantum physics. And then I kind of interpret all that through music. I make it all relatable through music because that's the language I express in. And so the talks I give in theaters, you know, before the performance, I talk about physics. I talk about ancient wisdom. And I bring the two together and connect the dots, and then use music to metaphorically give ourselves access to those ideas so that we can make them relatable, because we can't, you know, as best we can't see quantum physics playing out in front of us, where it's just not on our scale. And we can't see these, you know, incredible phenomena out in the universe with our bare eyes. We can learn about it in textbooks and from amazing physicists. We can read about it, but we can't really touch and feel it. But through music, we can actually gain access to that in a very different, very subtle kind of way.
So what are we going to experience when... Oh, Tom? Tom has a question?
Yes, Tom.
As the Asian in the room, you're doing the overachieving thing, man. You're making me feel bad about myself.
Please, I mean,
I should be the one who's doing physics and doing startup companies. Like, I tell fart jokes for a living. This guy is just...
Oh, wait, you don't know the half of it.
Well, your story was profoundly humbling, so, and thank you for that incredible
He climbed
story.
Mont Blanc.
Oh, God, I don't want to talk to you anymore.
The Grand Teton, and Filippo, I wasn't even going to mention it.
I have a Jewish mother. It's really tough. It's really tough. By the way, all you guys have the most amazing names that I'm totally envious of. Like, you have the most musical names, like Voltaggio and Lejeune. And you have an alliterative name, Tom Tran. It's like, mine is like, I can't even get the people at Starbucks to pronounce it right.
That's why the people at Starbucks call me Matt. I don't even tell my real name.
Exactly.
Go ahead, Mark. You could say...
I said, or the host of Life Changes, but that's...
Yeah. let me hear you pronounce it once again.
My name?
Yes.
It's Murray Hittery.
See, there's music to that.
Barely.
And in any event, so you... Did you end up writing your symphony? I want to know that.
So not only did I end up writing my symphony, and I did that while running the tech company, and I just worked on it in little bits and pieces, just baby steps, a few measures a day, till I got it done and had a dream come true to take it to St. Petersburg, Russia, and had it recorded there.
Wow.
And so that was amazing. And so I always kept in touch with the music as a personal passion, and I knew I would go back to the music as kind of a much bigger dream. And to your, you know, earlier you mentioned this idea that I have of no dream left behind.
Right.
And kind of taking from the, you know, the military concept of no man left behind, right? And so I kind of look at my life and say, you know, when I'm on my deathbed, when I look back at the life that I've led, I want to be able to look back and not see those kind of any shattered dreams left on the battleground of life. Mm. and want to look back and say, you know what, maybe not all of them worked, but I did my damn best to make it happen.
You're still a young man, so Tom, brace yourself, because I have a feeling he's going to do a lot more. So, I mean, we'll all just deal with it. in the meantime, what are we going to experience today?
So I create these real-time compositions, and it's a form of improvisation. Because it is meditation and reflection combining with contemporary classical music, kind of a post-minimalist soundscape. And so we'll go into it. And I like to leave the audiences with this visual as we go into it, which is kind of placing, imagine with the first note, placing a leaf into a river. And the river is a very powerful metaphor for life, past, present, and future, the flow of life, the twists and turns. Sometimes it's calm. Sometimes it's quite turbulent, the river, just like life. Sometimes there's rocks and obstacles. But eventually the leaf flows down the river, and like all rivers, it merges with the ocean. Hmm. And that's our home. That's the place where we feel that connection with ourselves, with each other. And so the music is about really connecting internally and through that, connecting with everything around us. So I invite you on a journey. It'll be a continuous musical piece that I'll share with you here.
And this won't have a title per se, right? Because it's...
The title is in the now. October 9th.
Okay, well, here is...
It's original, that title.
Here is Murray Hideri performing October 9th on the Life Changes Show, the experience of mind travel live here at Studio NoHo. Whoa. Didn't even want to break the silence. Mm. I was in that place where you took me. Thank you so much. We just all got to experience mind travel. Thank you to Murray Hittery. Did I say it right?
Beyond perfect.
Oh, beyond perfect.
Better than I say it.
What an experience. Thank you so much. People can go straight to mindtravel.com, actually. Yeah. So mind travel, just like it sounds, mindtravel.com, or to his website. You say you have different things on there?
Yeah, murrayhittery.com just kind of talks more about the kind of just my background, but mind travel is... has got all the upcoming events in different cities from Los Angeles to New York. And
there's a big event coming up in Los Angeles we need to talk about.
The biggest mind travel yet is going to take place in a couple months in January, on January 13th at the Epic Ace Theater in downtown Los Angeles. And not only are we going to have a solo piano on a 9-foot Steinway grand, thanks to my friends at Steinway, but we're also going to have a chamber orchestra by the incredibly talented Kaleidoscope Orchestra here based in L.A.
Wow.
And they are just epic. They're the best musicians in L.A., and they're joining me, collaborating with me to perform all my original work.
That's a huge theater.
It's a huge theater. It's, you know, just a few seats, about 1,600 of them.
Yeah. So very exciting. Yeah. So get your tickets now.
Yeah, they're available on the
before
site.
It's all and, sold out.
Yeah, they got good early pricing, and so I that's really a, would love to see everybody there.
That's a no headset experience.
No headset. Yeah, that'll be live acoustic. Not, you know, huge, gorgeous Steinway. The acoustics in that place are just amazing, and the vibe is amazing.
Fantastic.
Has Chris Carter asked you to write music for the new X-Files series?
Oh,
as I was
that
sitting,
would be
I was
fun.
Like, oh, season 11's coming up.
Yeah,
he should do the music for the X-Files. If that happens. You call me.
Done.
Call me.
Done.
Well, awesome. Well, I have a feeling a lot of things are going to happen. We know it, actually. So thank you so much again, mindtravel.com. And Murray, what a pleasure. And
thank you, guys. This is really fun.
You're some kind of person. And Tom Tran, you too. I mean, you have nothing to apologize about. Thank you for what you're doing.
Climb a mountain.
Oh, wait, there's more. Do you want to hear the...
No, I don't. I thought I accomplished something getting the cookies off the top shelf that my wife thought she hid from me today.
Oh, this is terrible.
All right, well, with that, thank you again to both of you. And Mark, you have a shout-out you want to do?
Yeah, we want to give Ruth McCartney a shout-out for hooking us up here, introducing us to Tom Tran. We love you.
Thank you, Ruth. And speaking of love, we have a lot of love here in the studio for our technical director at Studio NoHo, Brent Hahn, and a lot of love out to our program manager at BBS Radio Network, Doug Newsom. On behalf of Dorothy Donahue, our executive producer, and Mark Legere, our producer, I am your host, Filippo Voltaggio, reminding you that as your life changes, we're here for you. Ciao, everyone.
You have been listening to the Life Changes Show on the BBS Radio Network. Listen live every Monday night at 7 p.m. Pacific Time and visit us online at lifechangesnetwork.com, on Facebook at The Life Changes Show, and on Twitter at Life Changes Show. Join us again next week as we consciously explore and embrace the only constant, life changes. The Life Changes Network is an entertainment network. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and participants and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of Life Changes.